Sure.
So maybe we can just start with the formal stuff, if you don't mind. Just if you wouldn't mind stating your full name, your date of birth, and your place of birth.
Okay. Shirley Moy Wu, or W-O-O.
Your date of birth and place of birth.
January 9th, 1949.
And place of birth.
Oh, Washington, D.C.
Okay, great. So maybe let's start with a little bit of your family history, if you don't mind. When did your family arrive in Washington, D.C. specifically? Do you happen to know?
Well, they must have arrived before I was born. So it must have been maybe a couple years or 3 years before I was born, I would guess. Maybe 1946, something like that.
And do you happen to have any idea of why they settled in Washington, D.C. in particular, or not necessarily?
Not necessarily, because actually when my father came to America, he lived and worked in New York. And then during the war, he was in the Army. And then when he got out of the Army, I guess he felt it was time he got married. So in those days, people would go back to China to look for their wives to bring them over. So when he went back, he was introduced to my mother, maybe to other people too, I don't know. So then it just seemed, well, it was a good match or on both their parts, and they both decided to take that leap of faith to come over. Now, I'm not sure why they chose D.C., really. I don't know if they even they knew people here. First, actually, my mother has an uncle that at that time had an uncle, I should say, he passed away now, that lived and worked in D.C.
And so, what was his name?
His name is Harry Ng. And he worked in China, what was it called now? China Inn? It's not there no more. It's on 8th Street. It's a restaurant. So that's gone. And he was a cook there, a chef there.
Wow. So your mom had a family connection.
Yes.
And, but you're not sure if your dad did?
I don't think so, yeah. I know my father's history a little bit. He was adopted when he was probably a very young baby. His family was very poor, and they had three sons, and each of the three sons were adopted to different people. And so, and I don't think his family was even that wealthy that he was adopted to, so that's probably why he needed to make a living, and that's why he probably came over.
So where are your parents originally from? Like which part of China?
From the southern part, from Guangdong.
Guangdong.
From Toisan, yes. Yeah. So my mother remembers a little bit of the China part, but then it was during the wartime, so then her family ran to Hong Kong because, you know, the Japanese were bombing China. And so that's where she really grew up. And she doesn't remember that much about China. And I don't know how, I assume my father must have stayed in China until he was able to somehow, I think he was either sponsored or he bought papers to come to America. And that's why I think he went to New York, because someone helped him to come over, and then he wound up working in their laundry for a while.
And so your father was adopted into the Moy family?
Yes.
And do you happen to recall if sort of the origins of your family's laundry in Washington, right? Because your parents ran a laundry in Washington?
Right, or, yes. Yeah, at one time there were lots and lots of laundries.
Yeah.
Yes, I guess people didn't, you know, it's a government town and there were shirts that needed to be ironed. And maybe people didn't have wash machines as much. I'm not sure why. But there were lots of Chinese laundries, yeah. And my father actually lived and worked in one before he actually owned one on 8th Street, where they're really building up now.
Yeah. Do you happen to remember the name? Do you know the name of one that he worked at? Or
I'm not sure. I would have to ask my mother. But on 8th Street, there were other families there too. Not many Chinese families, but there were some. Yeah. And I remember because when I was born, we actually lived in that laundry, but downstairs was a laundry, and we lived upstairs. But then he worked somewhere else, And I remember as a little girl, I would want to go with them. We went somewhere around a block to a different place, yeah, where he had a laundry also.
So at that time, then you lived on 8th Street?
Yeah, for a while, until maybe I was maybe 3 or 4 years old. And then we had a laundry on Pennsylvania Avenue Southeast after the U.S. Capitol area. And that was a bigger place. But we also lived in the laundry. You know, the laundry was in the front. We lived in the back. Yeah, it was a really big place. I think downstairs was a cobbler who repaired shoes. And on the block, we had a barber shop, different things like that.
And do you happen to remember the name of the laundry on H Street that your father owned or ran? Or at least the address that...
I used to know it. I don't know. I'll have to give it to you later. Because my mother remembered it. And we tried to go back to find it.
Really?
It's not there no more. Maybe it's part of a shopping center or something else. Yeah.
And what about the one on Pennsylvania
Avenue?
That
one was, I think, called Dingho, D-I-N-G-H-O.
And do you happen to know the meaning of why that name was chosen for the
store? Well, it just means kind of, it means
Dingho
good.
The best.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Right.
And I'm curious how, what your experience was like at that time, growing up Chinese-American in Washington, D.C. in the 1950s and 60s. You know, was there an awareness on your part of being in a minority, or were you just too young at that point to, you know, grasp that?
Oh yeah, I think there weren't that many Chinese, so it was obvious that, you know, you were different. And actually, when we were very young, especially on H Street, there weren't that many women in around. So as a baby, I remember my mother said, "Oh, everyone was so excited they finally saw a baby," because most of the time they were men, just men.
Because of the exclusion.
The Exclusion Act. Yes. Yeah. So yeah, but even growing up and going to school, I think there was maybe one other Chinese girl in my class. So the whole school, of course, you stood out.
Yeah. And what school was that? What elementary?
It was called Orr, O-R-R, Benjamin Orr.
Benjamin Orr.
Yeah, in Southeast.
And what was the demographic, the racial demographic of the school and the neighborhood where you were?
Well, there weren't any, it was mostly white Americans. And I remember, I think it wasn't until maybe fifth grade until I was older when we finally had our first black student. That was a big deal too, believe it or not.
That must have been around the time of desegregation.
Yeah, it must have been.
1954, 1955,
right,
when DC schools started to integrate.
Yes.
What are your memories of that period, of that time?
Yeah, because I remember they sort of made a big deal of it, and maybe the teacher prepared us, like, you know, even though it seems strange now, like, oh, you're going to get this person who's not, you know, white. Even though I was Asian, a black person was going to come into school. Actually, it was a black boy, I remember. So they didn't make a big fuss over it. Yes.
And that was at Orr.
That was Orr. And then even going to, because we had a laundry, you know, our customers would, they went to church. That's why I went to church. So they said, oh, you should take your little girl to church. But they didn't go themselves because, you know, when you work 7 days a week, you're tired and the money. So they would come to pick me up to take me to the neighborhood church.
So customers of the laundry would come to pick you up.
Yeah, yeah. And just we just walked over. It was a neighborhood thing.
Yeah.
And then I remember that too because it got integrated too. And it was a big deal too because it was an all-white church. Except for me, probably. And now we had this black family. It's like, oh, we're going to have a black family come to church. Oh, and everyone should be, you know, nice to them.
And what church was that?
It's called Fountain Memorial Baptist Church.
Fountain Memorial Baptist Church. And was it one family that would bring you every weekend, every Sunday?
Yeah, basically. It was their children. I think they had teenagers older, and of course, than I was. So they could walk me over.
Did you remain close with that family or over time?
While we did. But then after a while, we haven't heard from them. Yeah.
Do you happen to remember their names?
Their last name, I think, was Halcombe. H-A-L-C-O-M-B-E, maybe. Yeah, but it's been a long time.
And what was the experience like for you as a child on your own to go with this family to church and then not necessarily having your parents, you know, what did that ever create any issues in the home over?
No, so sometimes I wanted to go with my family might wait for me on a Sunday so that we can go on an outing. Hmm. That's the only thing that took up time, yeah. Hmm. But it wasn't, you know, when you're a little kid, you just do what other people do. And there are other kids there too, they're children, so
yeah.
You play and just things like that. And then in maybe, did they have, that on the summer they would have a vacation Bible school. So then you know, it's sort of a fun thing. They have crafts, and you get cookies, Kool-Aid, things like that. So
it was a fun activity.
Yeah,
for
it was
you.
A fun. Yeah, it's like a it's like camp, I guess.
Yeah.
And then it because it's neighborhood, so that you saw your friends from school. They're there. Yeah, it's like that. I think now that people live in the suburbs, people don't necessarily have that same neighborhood type connection.
Mm.
But when you have the same people that live next door to you going, or you know, you play with in school, and they're just there too, that's all.
Mm. And do you know if your family was a part of any of the associations on Yong or the Moy Family Association or different associations in the city?
I'm not sure they actively joined.
Mm.
But, you know, I know that it was important a long time ago, especially when the early Chinese came, especially on Long Lang Association, because that's where you might meet and see people of your own kind, see people that was from your village, and maybe get tips for finding housing, maybe, or businesses that were for sale. Or sometimes I think they even pick people who didn't have mailboxes could pick up their mail there.
Mm.
Yeah. And then I know my father would like to come down on weekends to have maybe coffee in Chinatown. And this is a way to catch up with people on news, maybe from back home, or just to talk to somebody that could speak your language.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And was it? Do you know if there was a particular place, you know, restaurant or coffee shop that he liked to go to, or that you as a family came to?
Well, I remember
on the weekends?
There. I think it's what's it. What's it called now? The Joy Luck? What's it called? The one in the corner?
Oh, cafe.
The cafe.
Hmm.
That's next to the what's it? Roast beef place.
Oh,
yeah, yeah. It's a Joy Luck. It's not called. I keep saying it's Joy Luck, but it's not. It's Joy something. I think.
But it had a different name.
It had a different name back
name,
then.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not a very big place,
hmm.
So you could just sit there and have something. Oh, there were other restaurants too.
That you went to as a family?
Yeah, we didn't
China Doll.
Yeah, China Doll, maybe something like that.
Jade Palace.
Jade Palace, Ruby. Yeah, a lot of them are not here no more. Yeah. I think my uncle did work at China Inn. Yeah, it was called
China Inn.
I-N-N, yeah.
Were there grocery stores that you... your family shopped at in Chinatown, or did they do shopping?
You couldn't.
Regular
there were no
stuff?
Grocery stores in Chinatown.
Oh, really?
And actually, there was no dim sum in China. I think there was one place that had dim sum, but I think you did not. What you would do is you went to New York to stock up. So we take these trips to New York to drive there and try to go early in the morning so you wouldn't have to spend the night, and you would go to the grocery stores to buy all your produce, your canned goods. And maybe to eat Chinese food, real authentic Chinese food in New York, and not here. Yes. Mm-hmm. So then you would bring things back.
Mm.
But yeah, I don't remember. I don't think there were any stores here at that time.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Maybe later on, like Mei Welong.
Yeah, that's. Oh yeah, maybe they were always here, but.
But
maybe,
you didn't really go to
those.
Yeah,
maybe you might shop a little bit, but you figure it would probably cost more if we went to New York. Things are cheaper.
Yeah.
That's right. Mi Hua Lung was always here. Yeah, they're really old timers. Yes, that's right.
And in your home growing up, did your parents communicate in Cantonese or Toisanese with you, or was it in English?
Oh well,
or?
Because my mother, their family had to run to Hong Kong. She grew up knowing Cantonese, so when she married my father and came to D.C. everyone spoke Toisanese, and so she had to learn to speak Toisanese.
Oh, wow.
And so I didn't hear Cantonese, and then when I heard it, I was really surprised. Until I was a lot older, I said, "Oh, because Cantonese, I think, it's a very pretty language." Yeah, it sounds really nice. More prettier than Toisan, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And then at that time, I've never heard anyone speak, you know, Mandarin, you know, which now, of course, everyone in China is forced to learn. In a way, I think that's good that everyone in China does have one language. That's better, actually. So, you know, if you were to go to China a long time ago, if you were from one area, you couldn't communicate with somebody. They wouldn't know what you were talking about. Actually, we had gone back because my son worked in China, in Shanghai for a school semester teaching English. And we took my mother with us. And then, of course, she tends to want to speak to them in Cantonese, and they didn't understand a word she was saying.
Oh, really?
so they would prefer if she tried to even speak English to them and not speak her Chinese to them.
Oh, wow.
What's his name?
Timothy.
Timothy.
Yeah, yeah.
So you did speak then Toisanese in the house growing
yes,
up.
Yes, right, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was there a sense, what was the relationship of or view on China at that time, you know, communist China and your family? Was it, positive, negative, or mixed, or?
Oh, how did they feel about it?
Yeah, about China.
Well, they probably understood that China is a communist country. Or still is, I guess, and that is not a good thing. And they would hear stories, and especially, I think, I didn't realize this during the Red Guard, when they had all those upheavals in China. A lot of people were tortured, and I think stories got back how people were really, you know, mistreated. Yeah, and it was really, really, really hard. And then we would hear of people trying to get out. They would try to jump and swim across the river to Hong Kong. So they knew it was not a good thing to be in China. Yeah, and even in Hong Kong, it would be hard, you know, to make a living.
And do you have any memories of celebrating the New Year in D.C.?
I think when we were young, we were trying to go to Chinatown and to see the New Year parade. It's not as big as New York or Hong Kong, of course, but it was the only one that we had.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And after or school, elementary school, what schools did you go to?
We stayed in D.C. for a while. And see, what happened was my father passed away when I was 7. So, of course, my mother couldn't keep working in the laundry. So we moved closer to the elementary school for a while. And actually, my mother at that time took us back to Hong Kong so we could meet our grandmother. And we were there for the whole summer.
Oh, wow.
So we stayed there for a while.
What was the impact of that experience on you, you know, as a kid growing up in D.C. and then for a summer, you know, going to China and spending time with family there?
Yes, yes.
Did it have an impact on you?
Well, when you were little, and I think my brother was only like 5, maybe we were just playing around. And but of course, we knew we were in a different city, in a different country. And even though we're Chinese, people knew right away we were born in America. By the way we dressed, maybe we looked bigger or healthier, I'm not sure what it was. They would say, oh no, they're not natives there. They must be born abroad. And they could tell immediately. Hong Kong, it's still a very busy city. I mean, there are just so many people there. Then in Washington, D.C. and at that time, though, I think Hong Kong is a little bit better now with helping maybe poor people. And that time that they had a lot of refugees from China. So we saw all these little shanty towns, you know, little people were living in cardboard boxes. There were people begging. And then we had stayed in this apartment. Because we stayed the whole summer, we couldn't afford to stay in a hotel. So we had rented this room in this apartment. And people would knock on the door and they would beg for food in the evening. And so everyone in the apartment would gather their leftovers now. This is not their best food to put in a box to give these people. And because there's always a water shortage in Hong Kong, you had to save your water in the bathtub, and then there's only a certain time of the night you could only take a bath or something. So, you know, it's a hard living there because of the things that people lack that we have here, we take for granted here. So that I know, yeah.
And having that experience of, you know, well, going back for a summer, but otherwise growing up in D.C., what was your sense of your own identity? You know, some of the people we've interviewed who grew up in D.C. or, you know, first, second, third generation were saying that they would get by other Chinese Americans would get called Juk Sing. Like,
is that
something you experienced where people were saying, "Oh, well, you're not really"?
Yeah, that's
how,
right.
How did you? Was that an experience you had, or that?
Oh yeah, they would always say that. Yeah, yeah, because you know, of course, growing up, you're American more than Chinese. You don't understand the rules, the culture. You're not as polite, maybe, or something. So yeah, we were aware of that. Yeah. Mm. And I didn't realize it was not meant as a good thing to call that. Yeah, so, which is probably true if you're, you don't have maybe that, if you had been born in China, maybe you had a little bit more understanding of different rules and how you address your elders or something, respect.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yes.
And so you're saying about the schools after Orr Elementary.
Oh, yes. I went to 1 year to Cramer Junior High.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then we moved to Maryland, to Prince George's County in Suitland. My mother bought a home there.
Oh.
And then from there, I graduated from Suitland Junior High and High School.
Mm.
And then from there, I went to Maryland because we lived in Maryland, University of Maryland.
Uh-huh. College Park.
Yes, right, yes. I think at that time people didn't even think about, oh, you know, applying to going to far away. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, live in Maryland, you're going to go to Maryland.
Right. And what was your schooling experience like, you know, middle and high school before going to college? Was it a positive experience? Were there teachers that had an impact on you? Or was it more forgettable? I mean, were the things that stood out for you now as you think back about your middle high school experience in terms of activities you did or teachers that had an impact on you or
That's true.
Passions that you discovered?
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Maybe there wasn't during
the
middle high school
not
period.
Really. I can't say maybe I was not that fortunate to have, you know, a teacher that might have been a mentor or I looked up to or that inspired me.
Uh-huh.
That's true. Probably not. It was a pretty big high school. So maybe that might have been part of it. Yeah, I don't know. Mm-hmm.
And what did you decide to study when you went to University of Maryland?
I majored in history.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And what inspired that choice?
I'm not sure, even though, you know, I'm, you know, a Chinese and American. I've always been, I think, probably more patriotic than most Americans. I was always inspired by our American story, and that I think most Americans don't really understand or appreciate.
And were there any professors at Maryland that you remember that had an impact on you, or courses, or... you know, did you have ideas about what you wanted to do with this degree in history?
Well, I thought I might teach because, you know, that seemed to be the only practical thing, or work for the government. But no, not really. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so what did you decide to do after you graduated from Maryland?
Well, I did work for D.C. government for quite a while, yeah, in their personnel department.
Hmm.
Yes.
And what was your role there? What kind of a work did you do for D.C. government personnel?
I don't know if I could even... I'm not even sure what it was. Yeah.
But it was in the personnel.
Yeah, it was. It was, but it didn't really do... It's not what you think of as personnel...
human resources.
No, it wasn't like that at all.
Hmm.
It had to do with other agencies sending us things to evaluate or something. Yeah,
oh.
I'm not sure. it was a long time ago now, so I'm not sure really what they did really.
And when you were starting your career, did you maintain a relationship with Chinatown? Would you come on the weekends, or at that time were you kind of not?
Probably not as connected until I met this one couple that was connected, and then they had actually come to the church here, and they were interested in tutoring.
Oh.
in their English as a second language program. Mm. So they asked me to come to help.
And who were they, or what?
John and Madge Lem.
Oh, John.
Yeah, L-E-M. John.
Oh, yeah, because John at one time was the director of the
Center. Right, 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 yeah. He's very passionate about Chinatown, yes.
Mm-hmm. And what year was that you started coming here?
Oh, that must have been in the early 70s, maybe.
Oh, really?
Maybe 72 or 73 or something.
Oh, wow,
yeah.
So that was... Mm-hmm. So you've had a long relationship
with
the church and the service center.
That's right, yeah. So he was coming here with his wife for a while, and then we got to know each other pretty well.
Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know if the service center here was connected to what Helen Hayes was doing at the Calvary Baptist Church?
No, I know. No, it was not.
It was not, okay.
It was not, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And did you ever come across her during your time in Chinatown, or you never really crossed paths?
I think some other people did. Hmm. Yeah, I don't even talk to them, but they seemed to know her really well. And she must have been a big influence on their lives. I didn't know that, yeah. Huh. But her brother-in-law was the choir director here.
Oh, here?
Yeah, at the Chinese church. And then his the brother-in-law's wife is an artist, Dora Fu Lee.
Huh. And what was his name?
His name is Richard.
Richard
Lee, yeah.
Richard Lee. Oh,
his wife is Dora. Dora Fu, F-U-G-H Lee, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I think so. Is that her real name? Anyway, Dora Lee. Yeah.
So there was a connection, but it wasn't one that you necessarily time were...
No, yeah. And then my mother, I think, knows Helen more because she had a really good friend that we were really close to, Jeannie Lee. Ben Lee. Mm. And Ben and Jeannie Lee, especially Ben, we call him Uncle Ben, he knew a lot about antiques. He would go to auctions to buy them and then to resell them. Mm. And so I think Helen Hayes had a shop.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so she, because of that, my mother and this Aunt Jenny would go to her shop to bring her things to look at to see if she would buy them.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she did have a store, I think, on Wisconsin Avenue.
Yes.
Yes. And then when she gave up the shop, she donated a lot of her things back to the service center so we could resell during our fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, we still have some of them, I think. Yes.
Yes. And so what was the experience like when you started coming in the early to mid-70s to, you know, tutor? What was that experience like for you? To come, you know, to Chinatown and tutor. And were you tutoring? You know, were they young, high school?
Yeah, at that time we only did children.
Okay.
So these were kids that needed help with their homework. And then the other people who volunteered were young people too, like myself. Mm. And so it was very nice. Mm. And almost all the young people did not come to church. They didn't, I don't know how they knew about it.
Mm.
And they didn't have any association with us on Sunday, but I would come on Sunday.
Hmm.
But yeah, they really liked it and enjoyed what they were doing. And there were a lot of children at that time, and we could do maybe one to two, one to one, because we had so many volunteers.
Oh. Yeah. Like about how many students or young people did you have?
Oh.
Was it 15 or 30 or 40?
It must have been at least 15, 20 maybe or something. It was a lot.
Hmm.
And because I think the school didn't offer after school help.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of times it was just helping them with their homework or just reading with them or something like that.
And at that time, the service center was not located here, right? It was a different location? Or it was here? I don't know.
No, it was... I think it started when Onland gave them a space.
Hmm.
But then... And then finally it did move to... become part of the church space. Yeah. Actually, we have that written down somewhere. I can show you.
Okay.
Yes.
Right. And so when you were working, the service center was separate from the church, or was part of the church?
It was part of the church, but it wasn't maybe such a big deal as it is now.
Oh.
We only had maybe even only a part-time person.
Mm.
And then sometimes I think the pastor's wife would try to help part-time. And then it was just, you know, again, talking to people directly, trying to help them if they needed translation or they needed a ride somewhere or something like that. Mm. And it wasn't a full-time job. And even the hours of the center wasn't open that long.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a little bit different now that maybe I think we're probably the oldest community-based organization that's Asian-based in D.C.
Mm.
And because we've been here a long time, people tend to know about us. You know, people refer us through word of mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's becoming more so. Mm-hmm. Mm.
And was Reverend C.C. Hung here at the time that you started, or was he not here at that time?
I don't know. I think it was after he had
retired
or passed away. So it might have been a different pastor, I think, at that time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but I think we do have the yearbooks, I think. Mm-hmm. Well, list that I can show you later.
Mm-hmm.
You can read it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how did your work and relationship mm-hmm. with the center evolve over time? Because you're saying you started in the early, mid-70s. Is that something you maintained all the way through the 80s and 90s?
No.
Oh, okay.
Of course, by that time, you know, we lived in the suburbs, and
mm.
we just come here on Sunday, and then we had kids, and then they grew up. And
yeah.
I think because I wanted my son to be more connected, and I thought it might be good for him to feel like he could be a big brother. And they still had the children's program then. So then we started bringing him here to help, so he could help other kids too.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the center wasn't really formally established until 1971.
Okay.
Yeah. So that was way after Dr. C.C. Hung.
What was the, how did you end up meeting your husband?
Because he came to work here.
Oh, really?
You know, everyone comes to work in D.C., right? See, very few people are born here like myself.
Yeah, like yourself.
Because
yeah.
of the government. People get jobs here and then they come here.
Hmm.
And oh, it's because of, again, John and Madge Lim.
Oh, really?
Yes. Madge had met him when she was in Houston. He's from Houston.
Hmm.
And then she introduced us when he came here to work.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow. That's
yeah.
messed up.
And they were very helpful to newcomers too.
Hmm.
So they tried to help him, take him around to find a place to live.
Mm.
Things like that, yeah.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
So are they still around?
Yeah, they live in Leisure World, a retirement community in
mm.
Silver Spring.
Oh.
Yeah. And they come to church, I think, once a month now.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And how has the church changed over time in terms of the number of people or also the space? Because has it been at this location the entire time you've been attending?
No, we were at 1011 L Street.
1011 L
yeah.
Street, okay.
Mm-hmm. It was a much smaller space,
yeah.
much smaller. And then what happened was, because it was kind of small, and it was a pastor at that church, he thought we needed more room. And then Mount Vernon United Methodist Church, 900 Massachusetts Avenue, their congregation was dwindling. It's mostly seniors.
Mm.
At that time when we went over, they said their average age was 75.
Oh, wow.
And then we had more of the younger people. We had children.
Mm.
So then we were at their church for at least over 10 years. We had a joint ministry.
Oh, wow.
But then it's part of the United Methodist Conference.
Mm-hmm.
And then the United Methodist Conference didn't... If we wanted to stay, they wanted us to become part of their conference.
Mm.
And then Chinese people being more independent, we didn't want to do that. And then this became available. And this was a different church, too. It was a black, it was called Corinthian Church.
Mm.
I think it might have been a Baptist church. They were moving to the suburbs.
Mm.
And that's what happened, too. And then we still owned the 1011 L Street Church.
Uh-huh.
And... So what happened was the 1011 L Street Church is next to a Morris and Clark Inn, and they wanted more space for maybe a conference room or something.
Mm.
So then we said, well, so they helped us, you know, in exchange for that space for us to be on here.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, you can walk over to 1011 L Street. They kept the front, the old front, so it looks
really?
Like a, you know, still looks like a church in the front. But I guess... All behind it is new.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And how have the numbers of the congregation over the years? Have they decreased, increased, or?
Well, it's always, I think, been a small church. You know, I think churches in the suburbs will always be bigger. There's more parking. There's more families. So, and then people feel reluctant to come downtown. It's too much trouble. There's no parking. There's traffic. So it's never been a real big church. But if you look at through some of the your yearbooks, you see that at one time it seemed like, wow, there were quite a few people. You know, on a given Sunday, I think we have at least 200 some people. There are more people on row now. You know, how people only come once a year, or people might just only donate money, but you never see them, even though they remain members.
And is this the main space?
No, you go upstairs. This is this is the fellowship hall. This is where we have lunch. This is where we can have programs. Yeah, like that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we had it was remodeled from the other church. But upstairs is the sanctuary. So originally it was a church, a Presbyterian church, and then it became a Jewish synagogue. So you could tell when you look at the windows, and at one time it had a balcony where women would sit upstairs and men would sit downstairs. So we had that taken away. So but that's fairly new upstairs now, the renovation.
And I'm wondering how changes in the neighborhood that you've witnessed have impacted the church or the service center. Have there been differences over the years, I guess 30, 40 years now that you've been coming? And
Well, I think, of course, the neighborhood used to be more of a neighborhood. I guess everyone says that, where people might know each other more, where it was more quiet, maybe low-key. Of course, now we have all these high-rises, expensive condos, shopping, expensive stores. So it's different. And then I'm most people probably don't know anyone that lives in these apartments. But we still have some low income housing, and that's what we serve at the service center.
And do you find that any of the tenants, I guess at Wallach House or Museum Square, actually are members of the church, or is it their relationship more through the service center?
We do have people that are members that live there. But I guess I would say most of the people are probably just, our association is just through the service center. We do,
And so those are the two populations, or the two buildings that you interface with most of the service center, or people that have no relationship to those places often also come to the service center?
Yeah, they come too, We have, there's another one on 7th Street, Gibson Plaza. Yeah, they come, and then there's, what's it called, Carmel Square, and of course, there are different places that people do live around here, but as Chinatown has been bought out by other people, so then people are not renting them out, of course, to Chinese immigrants. They're being changed over to more, I guess, more profitable, maybe Caucasian places, restaurants and stuff. So at one time, people were able to rent rooms. But now it's becoming more difficult to find a place to rent that's affordable. So it's going to be more and more difficult, I know,
And in your family, in terms of the places and the properties that the laundries existed in, were those properties that, like for instance on 8th Street, that your family owned and sold or rented out to do the business there?
I think we just rent it. I don't think we actually own them. I think even the one in Southeast we did not own.
And so I'm curious what your thoughts are on the kind of changes in the neighborhood. You know, I mean, in a sense, the location of the church is like prime real estate in some ways. How, you know, what are your own personal feelings about the changes around you? You know, do you have mixed feelings? Do you think it's all positive to see the development, or negative, or somewhere in between?
Well, it's always good and bad and everything, right? It's good that it's, you know, cleaner now, it's safer now. But of course, it's bad when people can't afford to live here. You know, regular people that have low-paying jobs, it's just very hard to pay rent here. So I'm not sure what's going to happen to neighborhood, especially our immigrant families, community. you know, it'd be nice if people can somehow work it out that they can still stay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, because if you walk up on K Street now, you see all these really nice restaurants that they would never go to, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But somehow they live really close to them, and they're trying to get them out of there, especially at Museum Square.
Mm-hmm.
That's really very prime property.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And has the service center worked on any of those issues, or mainly more day-to-day?
Yeah, we do more the day-to-day, but we have hosted meetings, and we're aware of what's going on. And then the other one, Housing Counseling Services, Asian American Legal Resource Center, they're helping them a lot, and I think Legal Aid Society. So they keep us in touch. So, and then sometimes what happens is the people live there, they bring us their notices that they don't understand or can't read, even though it may even be in Chinese, but some Chinese people really can't really read that much, even in Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for them.
Mm-hmm.
So and then people are scared, so they want to leave. So I'm not sure what's going to happen there, really. I hope that something can be worked out, that they can stay at least, you know, for low income, for some subsidized housing. I don't know how they could mix it up, though. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any memories of how different development projects in the neighborhood over the years have impacted the neighborhood? So, for instance, like the construction of the Metro Stop in the 70s,
mm-hmm.
or the original convention center,
yes, right.
On H and between 9th and 11th.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any memories of how those developments impacted
mm-hmm.
the neighborhood, or not? Not really.
No. I guess I'm sure it did change things. It brought more, you know, business maybe, more foot traffic, obviously. And maybe it did help Chinatown for a while. But then now it's because its property is worth more to these original owners. They're selling out, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Why stay if people are offering you, you know, millions of dollars?
Yeah.
So I think at one time it might have helped bringing people to eat here.
Mm-hmm.
But not so much anymore.
Mm.
Yeah. It's unfortunate we don't have really good, maybe, restaurants here, Chinese restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
People have to go to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And could you maybe tell us the story of how, well, you started work tutoring in the 70s,
uh-huh.
and then in the late 90s, you became the director of the service center. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So what was that experience like of becoming, you know, a director of the service center?
Well, we're very small. I mean, compared to other organizations that have, you know, a bigger budget, that have a really good working staff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just basically, sometimes I think it's just me. I do have a committee,
mm-hmm.
and then we only hire one person who's here day to day. So sometimes when I say that I'm the director, and then we have, and maybe because we're called the Chinatown Service Center, the word center, people think it's a huge place, and it's really not that way at all. It's really very simple. So a lot of things, you know, I do because I've been here a long time. I know a lot of people. It's relationships you develop, you know, through networking, just working with people, so people know me. So I try to go to different functions when I can, but I'm not able to do everything.
Right.
And we don't really have the resources, really.
Mm.
Yes. And, I mean, sometimes I wish we could do more, but then in some ways, maybe it is good that we stay small, too.
Mm-hmm.
So again, there's good and bad in that, too.
Yes.
So I'm not sure what's going to happen, really. Because in time, because we're more volunteer-based, I'm a volunteer, too.
Mm.
I don't know what's going to happen because younger people don't want to seem to take up the work.
Mm.
You know, it takes time, it takes effort,
mm.
and you really, I think it's always been my saying that you have to have the heart, you really have to really want it to do it. You really feel that it's needed, you really have to feel for the people, and I don't know if that's going to happen, it's going to continue.
Mm.
I mean, even our Saturday English classes, it's only because we have volunteers, and no one, again, is from our church. It's only my husband and I.
Mm-hmm.
So in time, I don't know what's going to happen,
mm-hmm.
if it's going to continue or not. So we'll just have to, again, wait and see.
Where do you think your sense of commitment to these issues and to this work comes from? Because not everyone has that passion to work with people and to help people. What do you think the source of that is?
I'm not sure I know either. I think everyone must have their different passions and their different likes. So that's why I understand that. Not everyone's going to want to do this. Everyone has their own cause, so to speak. So everyone needs to follow that. I think that mildly just growing up, you know, being a Chinese American in Washington, D.C., and maybe relating to the people here. I don't speak Mandarin, and now most of the people that come speak Mandarin. But somehow a lot of them think I do. Anyway, so it doesn't matter. So, and because I can walk, you know, down the street and most likely will run into somebody that will recognize me, that will know me. Yeah. So that, I guess, is my satisfaction.
And what, can you just describe for us what the day-to-day activities or services of the service center are? You know, so you have the English classes. What are the kind of day-to-day, week-to-week, what occupies most of your time?
Well, this is Elisa who works here, and then she intakes directly with the people. So it depends on who walks through the door. So it depends if, you know, somebody will bring in a form that they want her to help fill in, or make a phone call for something, or they're asking for help for immigration. We do a lot of referrals. We don't say we're experts in anything. So we know about Legal Resource Center, we could call them up. Domestic violence, it could happen too, that someone's having problems with their spouse, and then we could refer them to that. So day-to-day work is a little bit different. And then for me, it's just maybe overseeing, making sure everything is going well. And then Wednesday we have a citizenship class. We only have classes 2 days a week, Wednesday and then Saturday morning. And most of our class attendance is on Saturdays from 9 to 11. And again, they're taught by volunteers. So this is when, and most of them, it's because they've been doing this for a long time. At one time, most of them were working, a lot of them were retired now, but they're still coming back to do their volunteer work. And then because they're free, it's not a school, so it's not particularly, you know, structured. So we try to do what we think the students want, and sometimes they will tell us. They say, I really want to learn grammar more. I really need to understand the menu of this restaurant I'm working at. And then I'm trying to be a mechanic, so I need to go through these terms. Or we had someone who wanted to be a taxi cab driver, and there were so many rules, and you had to know the names of the street, so you would have to help them with that. So that's different too on Saturdays. And then attendance varies too. At one time, we could have had as many as 25 to 30, but now I think it's more like maybe 12, 10 to 12, yeah, something like that.
And that's for the Saturday class?
That's for the Saturday class.
And the Wednesday class?
Wednesday doesn't have that many people. They have maybe two or three,
And most of them are living in the Wallet House? Or
They're from all over the city. And then some people actually come from Maryland. They take the bus or subway just to get here. I guess we've had some people from Virginia too. They'll make the effort to travel. And then because we're listed with the DC Public Library and Martin Luther King, we also have people that are not Chinese. So from time to time we'll have people from, you know, from South American countries, from Europe. And I have this one Korean lady, she lives in Southeast, I think Martin Luther King Drive or somewhere. It must take her over an hour to come here on the bus, I think. But she's very faithful. She's a senior. And then she does not have a Korean last name. So her husband, I'm just guessing, must have been like an American soldier. And he passed away some time ago. And somehow she found us. And she's been coming for many years now. And then a lot of times it's not... And she does speak English, but I think she's more lonely, more like this is an outlet for her to do, something to do every Saturday to come, to talk to somebody, to make a friend or something like that.
In terms of, you know, we're talking about some of the changes, have you seen the rise of services in places like Rockville, Gaithersburg,
oh, yeah.
Falls Church.
Mm-hmm.
How has that changed, you know, the work that you do? Have you had to kind of keep up with abreast of and know about all the services that are popping up in different parts of the region in order to connect people with those resources?
Yeah, they do have, because there are more Chinese that live in Maryland now, in Rockville, Silver Spring, you know. And I think they do have their other community centers out there too.
Mm.
Yeah. We don't really connect with them that much, except maybe we could tell people, if you live there, you need to maybe try to go there to get help.
Mm.
But a lot of people still come here. They just feel more comfortable with us.
Mm.
Yeah. Maybe they don't do as much. I don't know if they have full-time staffing for that, or they're into social services as much. A lot of them have maybe more activities for, you know, like exercise, for crafts, or something like that.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And this issue you were talking about in terms of not having a next generation to take up the mantle, so to speak.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Why do you think that's the case? And you know,
mm-hmm.
What mm-hmm. is there anything that can be done about that?
I don't know. That's hard to say.
Yeah.
I'm not sure why either. Yes. Mm-hmm. In some ways, I think young people are usually more idealistic, but I'm not sure that's true anymore either. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe people are more concerned about making a living, you know, making money, getting a job, saving money so you can buy a place, or having money to go out to eat and having fun.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure. I'm not sure what's happening either. I don't know. I'm not sure what can be done about that either.
Mm.
You know, again, having the feeling or the passion or the, that, I don't know, that how much has to come, you know, from yourself, or somehow you see this need.
Mm.
And if you don't or quite understand it, or you don't relate to it, then it doesn't mean anything to you.
Mm.
I know what, you know, our church has three congregations, which is pretty remarkable. You know, we have Cantonese, English, and Mandarin. And sometimes these three congregation and members of it don't really mingle either.
Mm.
Because maybe people feel that, you know, it could be the language too, or people are different, or, you know, they don't understand. Oh, no, I live in the suburbs, and, you know, I have my own, these problems, these people live in the city, and it's not the same. But so I don't know what will happen.
Hmm.
We try to be optimistic. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so that means you have, on a Sunday, services back to back in three different, or is it happen? Yeah. How does that work?
They're different. The Mandarin service will meet down here. The Cantonese meet earlier, and then when they leave, the English service goes in.
And that's upstairs.
Upstairs in the sanctuary. Yes. Mm-hmm, yeah.
And what are the numbers like in each, in terms of which one has the biggest and
mm-hmm.
smallest?
Yeah, well, the English service is the biggest one.
Mm.
See, we're unusual because it's a Chinese church, but an English-speaking Chinese church.
Right.
both the Mandarin and Cantonese are smaller. And I think the Cantonese in time will even be smaller
mm-hmm.
as more and more people are speaking Mandarin.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they don't, I don't know, maybe Cantonese might have, I'm not sure, 30 to 40? I really don't know. We can find out the membership. And then the Mandarin, they don't have that many either.
Mm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the English service has the most. Yeah. It could be over 100, I would guess, every week. Mm-hmm.
And does that mean you also have to maintain like three pastors? overlap in terms of someone able to speak all three? Or
yeah.
How does that...
Yeah, well, we have a lot of guest speakers, too.
Okay.
And actually, right now, our senior pastor, he does speak Cantonese and Mandarin.
Hmm.
And then our associate pastor, he's not Chinese at all. He's half Japanese from Hawaii. He'll be actually leaving pretty soon.
Oh.
He's going to go to the West Coast.
Hmm.
So we're searching now for another pastor.
Hmm.
I think it would be ideal if that pastor could at least be bilingual, even if he couldn't preach, but he was able to at least connect in conversation to talking to people
mm-hmm.
in one of those languages. I think that would be nice too.
Mm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not easy finding, you know, people who are good in two languages. It's very difficult. I understand that. Most people cannot, you know, read and write and speak really well in two languages. Yeah. Yes. It's very hard. Yes.
And I'm wondering if you have a kind of a vision for the future of the service center, things that you would like to do moving forward, or things that you would like to develop, or is it sort of a maintain the work that you're doing now going forward? Or,
well, I guess we try to maintain. I don't know if how much. Maybe it depends on, maybe on resources. Maybe if someday they're able to hire maybe a really official a director, maybe they could do more. And then I think it's good that it is part of the church, but then also at the same time it may hold it back too. Yeah, because I think being part of the church, it gives it that heart part, that, you know, there's no strings attached. They do it because they feel that there's a need, there's a care there that you don't get by paying someone to do. But by not paying someone, you don't have someone who maybe could devote maybe more time and hours. And maybe if it wasn't quite connected, maybe it could be a little more bold, you know. It could step up a little bit more and speak out more. But because it's part of church, it tends to be a little bit more timid. You know, we don't say, even though people may say, well, you signed this petition. And then most of the time we think, you would like to in your head, but you know, probably it would not be looked on. So you don't. Yeah, you see.
Are there questions that you have?
You know, this is one of the spaces, like the 1882 Foundation usually have their talk story. And so we would like to know, like, when did that start and how you get in touch with each other.
You probably should ask Ted and Stan. Actually, I must have met them somewhere. Yeah, and they've been remarkable. They do this more than full time, and they're volunteers too with that project.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really quite a guy. I don't think he ever sleeps. He's involved in everything. Yeah, I must have met him somewhere, and then he had asked, he wanted to do these talk stories. To have to keep the remembrance alive about Chinese history or Asian history. So that's why he's been trying to get speakers, authors, whatever, to come at least once a month to do this. Actually, long time ago, there was a man, Dr. S.Y. Leung, who worked for Voice of America, S.Y.L.E.U.N.G. Leung, yeah. And he had a culture series at the church where he would invite people to come speak. Yeah, I remember we had this one author. She's a professor now. I think she's retired though, and she went to New York, and she wrote about, it's called The Gold Mountain, the book.
Yeah.
She's still alive, I think, but she lives in New York, and she came and talked about that. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
So he was trying to find different things to enlighten the church members. But now we have our talk story. Most of the people who come are not from church, if you notice. They're from, you know, other places that Ted's been able to advertise, and every time he gets a chance, he'll tell people to come. So the attendance has been pretty good. At one time, I thought there wasn't that much interest, but I think it's picking up. Yeah. But yeah, you should talk to Ted. Will tell you lots and lots of things, I'm sure. And Stan, too. Yeah. Stan is part of OCA. And Ted's more part of CACA, Chinese American Citizen Alliance. Yeah.
I'm wondering if maybe to conclude, you have any thoughts or reflections about what DC's Chinatown has meant to you in your lifetime over the years through its many changes, you know, kind of what has it meant to you?
Well, I guess you could look at it as just a place where there are Chinese stores and shops and it's becoming less so, but it's still considered Chinatown, even though less and less people are, you know, shopping here, less Chinese people, and there are less people, you know, living here. But I guess it's sort of like an anchor, maybe. And then maybe it's more than maybe just the physical presence. It's just the idea that there is a place that at one time that was kind of more thriving, that was more vibrant. But still, there are Chinese people that live here in D.C. or around D.C. And even though people do shop in the suburbs, and I shop in the suburbs, there are more stores and restaurants. But hopefully there will still be you know, a place that people can still come. Mm. And hopefully there will still be a few hole-outs of stores somehow. Mm. Yeah. So I don't know what's going to happen to that either. Mm. You know, if especially if people are not allowed or can't afford to live here, what would they do? They won't even walk around here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think the city is doing that with the market they're trying. And we have that Chinatown Park across the street. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're trying to have activities there to sort of keep that going. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so.
And so in some ways the suburbs have replaced the city in some respects, yeah, with the grocery stores and mm-hmm. restaurants. Mm-hmm. But what are there ones that you think are the best or most important in terms of bringing the most people, you know, to do their shopping there or going to eat?
Oh, the big stores, maybe?
Yeah. Are there any that are your favorite that you go to or restaurants? Oh,
yeah, of course we go to the Great Wall, yeah, you know.
In Rockville or?
I live in Virginia, but I've gone in Rockville too, because my mother lives in Wheaton, so I go over that way too. Mm-hmm. But in Virginia are more Korean stores, big mm-hmm. stores, which is mm-hmm. nice. They're closer to us, yeah. Mm-hmm.
H-Mart,
yeah, they're everywhere. They've done really well. But yeah, and then in Maryland, because my mother lives in Wheaton, she knows those, you know, Paul Key, Fu Key, mm-hmm. Wong Ji. Mm-hmm. What's that new one called? Inspiration something. I think it's on University, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of them. And near Leisure, where there's Fu Lin, mm-hmm. yeah.
And actually, a lot. Some of those were formerly DC Chinatown.
Oh yeah,
businesses
yes, yes.
You know, relocated.
Yes, that's right. Mm. Mm-hmm. Especially, I think, is it Gyeongfong? I think they went out there. Mm. Mm-hmm. That's true.
And has that changed at all your own personal social network of people and friends? The fact that now the suburbs more than the city are, you know, are there places that mm-hmm. you know? You spend more time out, aside from your job or your work here, mm-hmm. that you spend out in the suburbs than in the city, or?
Because my mother lives in Wheaton, mm. and then she knows a lot of the owners, the waiters there. So sometimes there are like two or three restaurants that we sort of take turns going to, almost maybe not every week, but every other week we'll go meet her, and then we go out to eat there. Mm-hmm. And then in Montgomery County has these great senior programs too. Where the seniors pay a couple dollars for their lunch, mm. and I think the county must subsidize it. Mm. So yeah, they like that a lot. But yeah, we go out to the suburbs to eat more Chinese food than in D.C. Mm. Actually, in D.C. there's one, even the China Boy.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. They're still here. Mm. Yeah.
And they've been here for many years.
Oh or? Yeah, they've been here for many years and. Actually, it started too because they realized that there was no place here that made the white flat noodle, the fun noodle, the Hong Fun noodle. Mm. People would have to go to New York. So then the lady, actually, she's related to Uncle Ben about the antique shop.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so when she came, she was very good at business minded. And then she had to get the machine that made the rolling from New York. And then she opened this factory here. So ever since then, and then her children, of course, didn't want to continue. Mm. So now other people have are owners of it. They have different shares.
Mm-hmm. And do you happen to remember what her name was, who set up the originally?
Yeah, I can get that for you. Yeah, we call her something else in Chinese, but I haven't. I have to give it to you. Yeah, mm-hmm. She's a Li.
So are there any last questions or last thoughts you want to share about?
books. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, like, what do you think, like, what time period is the peak of, like, Chinese immigrants' population in Chinatown? And then what is the turning point when, like,
when there were more
the
people
peak,
here?
Yeah, the peak, the height of one.
I don't know, maybe in the 80s, maybe? When there were a lot, yeah. I guess the turning point was maybe the convention center. Yeah, when that came. And then, of course,
The MCI Center,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Mm.
Yeah, and then maybe that took out a lot of the neighborhood, the residents, or things like that. Yeah, you probably have to ask people who live here.
Mm.
They might have felt the impact more.
Mm.
Yeah, and then things seemed to happen very fast, maybe in the 90s or something. And now we have all these, you know, great buildings. And at one time people wouldn't come here, I'm sure, because it seemed kind of scary.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of, you know, robberies and thefts and all kinds of stuff. And even back at the old church at 1011, it was not considered, you know, a good neighborhood to walk around in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so you'd be afraid. And then we had these transvestite, you know, they were, you know, men dressed up as women. They were obviously, even in the daytime, you would see them.
Mm-hmm.
And now you don't see them anymore. So I'm sure there must be around somewhere. They must have moved them out. But now it's becoming, of course, more difficult to park here. At one time, it was easy to park here, as you find out.
Yeah.
Are you sure you're okay there?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because really, they give you tickets so quickly.
Mm.
Yeah.
It's true.
You better check on your car. Yeah.
Any other questions? Or? No? Any other last thoughts you want to share just about Chinatown or your work or your time here? Or
no, I think you all did a good job. You did a very good job. You both did a good job.